to part by request. Some of the members of the shul have asked me to give them a quick review of my previous part of the previous three lectures, which are sort of a general background of Islam and the structure of the Quran and the behavior in Islam. And the second part of the lecture will be more direct, and it will deal with actually the first 30 years approximately of Jewish experience under Islam, from approximately the year 622 to about the year 650 CE. One of my teachers at Columbia University was a man named Moshe Hel, Allah Shalom. And Moshe Hel, when he taught Navi, and especially when he was teaching the Sefer Yeshayahu, or Sefer Yechezkel, or Sefer Yirmiyah, he would ask us to forget that we are in Columbia University and try to imagine that we are in Chutzot Yerushalayim, listening to the Navi, listening to what the Navi had to say. And we're sitting here right now in Oel David Shlomo, overlooking the Shitzet Bay Canal. It's very, very difficult to imagine ourselves approximately 1400 years ago in the Arabian Peninsula. Well, we have to try to do that. We're not in New York City. We're not even in Brooklyn, New York. But we're in the Arabian Peninsula, which, to use the vernacular, was nowhere. Nowhere in the world. Because the great powers in the 6th and 7th century CE, the great powers of the world were not in the Arabian Peninsula. The great powers of the world were in the Persian Empire of the Sasanians and in the Eastern Roman Empire. Those are the great powers of the world. And in that 6th century, they warred back and forth across parts of North Africa, into Western Asia, into the Arabian Peninsula, but not very deep into the Arabian Peninsula, into parts of Africa. And it was their world, actually, much as in the 1960s and 1970s, the great powers were the Soviet Union and the United States. So what was there in the Arabian Peninsula in the 7th century, or late 6th century, and 7th century CE that was going on? Very simply, very little. It was a caravan route. If this is the Arabian Peninsula, this is the Red Sea. This is Yemen. It was a caravan route that went along the coast into Palestine and as far as Damascus, sometimes going up until the Turkish border and back. And in the Arabian Peninsula, in the 7th century CE, there was one major city, which was Mecca, more properly Makkah, M-A-K-K-A. It was this city, the city of Makkah, approximately in the year 570 CE, that Muhammad was born. Muhammad ibn Abdullah, actually. Didn't know his father, but his father's name was Abdullah. There's very, very little that we know about Muhammad that's historically accurate during the first 40 years of his life. His years, just to let you know, were approximately 570 CE. He was dead in 632 CE. So he lived in round numbers approximately 62 years. Discounting Islamic legends, Midrashim, We do understand that he was a shepherd. About the age of 25, he married a woman who was much older than he was, whose name was Khadija, a rather wealthy woman, who owned or managed a caravan route which went from Mecca into what is today Israel, of course, Jordan, and into Syria. We don't know what Muhammad learned in his travels. The Arab world, unlike the Western world, which we're part of course, is not interested in historical speculations. The Arab world is not interested in, or very little interested in, archaeological dig. The Arab world takes what it says in the Quran literally. It says in the second chapter of the Quran, ذَلِكَ الْكِتَابُ لَا رَائِبَ هُدَّنَ الْمُتَّقِينَ أَلَذِينَ يُمِنُّنَّ بِالْغَيْبِ. This is the book, in it is no doubt, for those who believe in God and believe in the unseen. So they aren't going to speculate as to what happened in these first years of Muhammad's life. They will take what they have in their tradition literally and accept it as fact. We have to understand that. But we in the West, we try to reconstruct from this midrashic material a biography of sorts. And the biography is based upon several early texts. Just get the eraser. Basically, we have three very important texts to base our biographical material of the life of Muhammad upon. One is Quran, which is the Islamic holy book, and we'll speak more about that later. The second is a book is called Kitab, which is the Arabic word for book, like Kotev in Hebrew. Kitab al-Maghazi. Kitab al-Maghazi is a book of wars, literally. And then we have a book is called Sirat, Ar-Rasul. The story of the Rasul, the messenger of God. None of this material, with the exception of possibly, and I'm emphasizing possibly Quran, is contemporary with Muhammad. The Kitab al-Maghazi and Sirat al-Rasul were written between 150 to 200 years after his death. You have to bear this in mind. It's very, very important understanding this. Now, getting back to our biography. When he was about 40 years of age, he was wont to go into a certain cave outside of Mecca, and the cave was called Hira, H-I-R-A. In one of his meditative nights in Hira, he heard a voice speak to him. This is the beginning of the Quranic revelation, when he is about 40 years of age. And it's, if I remember correctly, the 95th surah of the Quran is the first revelation that comes to Muhammad. And of course, he's greatly petrified. He doesn't know what to make of this. He perspires profusely. He's trembling. He's shaking. He's cold and warm at the same time. And he runs home to his wife. And his wife had a cousin who was possibly a Christian. We're uncertain, but the sources are somewhat conflicting in different books. But this cousin of hers assured him that the voice of God has come to you, and you are the chosen messenger for the Arab people. Now, to reconstruct the times of the 7th century, if Muhammad were alive 50 years earlier, or if Muhammad were alive 50 years later, according to Western scholarship, his message would have fallen on deaf ears. Now remember, we're speaking as Western investigators. We are speaking as Muslims. Muslims have a whole different attitude. So there is absolute truth. No question, no speculation, no investigation. But during the 7th century, throughout parts of the Arabian Peninsula, there were different groups of warners, people who had a belief in one God, and we call them, in Arabic, we use two terms in Arabic. One is Hanif, Hanif is something like an itinerant preacher who has no particular message to deliver except for the fact that you have to believe in one God. Remember that the Arabs at this time, the majority of Arabs in the 7th century were polytheistic. In fact, many of the idols that they worshipped were around the Kaaba in Mecca. The Kaaba was a sacred stone, which we'll speak more about later. A second word is a wa'iz. And a wa'iz is something which is like a warner. Someone who is warning people that a disastrous punishment will await you if you don't rectify your conduct. And throughout the Arabian Peninsula, especially in the north, we find this activity. Muhammad, at the beginning of his career, would probably fit into this category of Hanif or Wa'iz, because the earliest revelations, the earliest message Muhammad delivers is to repent, Tawbah, to repent, to believe in one God, and to behave in a particular way that's meritorious. That's the essence of his early belief. Once he's assured himself that he's chosen and the messages of God come to him more frequently, Muhammad starts gathering around him a number of converts. Now, what I should have told you, that in the year 610 CE, there was one Muslim in the world. You have to understand that. You look at one person. We are all individual people. One person who believed in Islam, but today we have 1,300,000,000 Muslims in the world. That's a number, I'm just throwing that number out at you. It's hard to believe. 1,300,000,000 is the fastest growing religion in the world, in the United States, and in New York City. You have to understand that. Things, we have to put things in perspective. 1,400 years ago, there was only one. That number has multiplied beyond our ability to even imagine. So Muhammad, getting back to our biography, gathers around him a number of followers, people who believe in his message. Now, of course, we are looking at things objectively, and we have to perhaps reject one tradition in favor of another. So one tradition would say that Ali was his first convert. The Shia tradition leans more to Ali. And who was Ali? Was his cousin. His father and Ali's father were brothers. Another tradition would say Abu Bakr was the first convert. And who was Abu Bakr? My students should remember. He was the first successor to Muhammad, the first of the caliphs. Another tradition would say that Khadija was his first convert. Thing being as it may, he starts with either one of these three or these three. But gradually his message begins to develop in the town in which he lives, which is Mecca. Mecca was a center of polytheistic worship in the Arabian Peninsula. We have to remember, in the Arabian Peninsula at this time was mostly tribal life. people belong to a tribe, much like I imagine it's still true in Iraq, in Baghdad, and other cities in Iraq. And in Mecca, the predominant tribe was called the Quraysh. This is the tribe that Muhammad belonged to. He wasn't a particularly wealthy member of the tribe, nor was his family particularly poor. He fits somewhere in between. But of course, his message of believing in one God, his message of warning that something will befall you if you don't correct your behavior, his message of rectitude, proper conduct in business transactions, his message of honesty between people, members of the same community, these messages fall negatively on the ears of the members of the Meccan community. And between 610 to 622, 12 years, although the numbers of Muslim converts grows, the problem in the community also multiply. Until, through negotiation, Muhammad negotiates an exit from Mecca. Now you may have been taught in school that Muhammad left because he was a threat upon his life. And this of course is called, in Islam, it's called the Hijra. Translated into English as a flight. This is not really true. There were negotiations some miles from Mecca in a place called Aqaba, where approximately 70 members of Muhammad's followers negotiated with some of the wealthier town people in Medina to have Muhammad leave Mecca, come to Medina, and resolve intertribal warfare, intertribal disputes that were occurring in that town. So it's 622 is a key year in the history of Islam. This is year one in the Islamic calendar. So we number in Islam from the year 622 CE down to the present day, to give us the Islamic calendar as of today. 622 is 1 AH after Hijra, AH, until today. Before the Hijra, in Islamic terminology, is called Al-Jahiliyyah. Al-Jahiliyyah period is a period of ignorance. Jahil is ignorant. Jahiliyyah is a period of pre-Islam. It's a period when the Arabs were disunified, when polytheism was rampant throughout the Arabian Peninsula. Any questions so far on what I've been saying? Okay, now moving on with the story. By the year 622, when Muhammad makes his flight from Mecca to Medina, we find that we go from the Meccan period to the Medinan period, not only in terms of geography, but also in terms of the role Muhammad is going to play in the community, in the Islamic community. In Mecca, Muhammad's role was somewhat of a hanif or wa'i, between a warner, someone who warns people, or someone who's delivering a message about a belief in one God, to reject polytheism. When he arrives in Medina, Muhammad is going to assume three roles. As my professor helped me to say, he wore three different hats. One was the hat of Nibu'ah. He now is convinced he's a prophet. A second hat is the hat of a lawgiver. And the third hat is the hat of a military leader. Muhammad will model his career upon the career of Moshe Rabbeinu. He wears the same three hats as Moshe Rabbeinu. Nevuah, Manhig HaTzavah, the leader of the army, and politics. Same three lawgiver, the same three laws that Moshe Rabbeinu has. Also, we find in the Quran, we find that each and every chapter of the Quran has the name of the revelation, where it was revealed. The early chapters were revealed in Mecca. The later chapters in Medina. 115 chapters in all. I'll speak more about the Quran a little bit later. In the city of Medina, you find that Muhammad is confronted with a different type of adversary. The adversary in Mecca was a polytheistic adversary who could not challenge Muhammad in matters of religion. In other words, there was no attempt to challenge his knowledge of Scripture. There was no attempt to challenge his knowledge of what God wants or what God doesn't want. There was no attempt to challenge his knowledge of Sharia, which is Islamic law. Once in Medina, however, things begin to change. Because in Medina, we find that there were two elements living there. We have a Jewish element. We find the tribe of Banu Nadir. I'm giving you only the names of the larger tribes. There were supposed to be 20 different Jewish groups living in and around Medina. But I will give you only the names of the three major groups. We have Banu Qurayza, and we have a third group, Jewish groups now, Banu Qunafa. Then we have two pagan groups, pagan Arabs, being Arabs that were polytheistic, living in Medina, Banu Aus and Banu Khazraj. Of these five different groups that were living in Medina, it was the Jews that would present Muhammad with the greatest problems. Now, it's very, very difficult to reconstruct objectively what Muhammad believed in, what he didn't believe in, what his intentions actually were initially when he made his prophecy known to the Jews. Now, I know what traditional scholarship says, but I know also what speculative scholarship says. Traditional scholarship would say that he claimed to be the last in a series of prophets. The seal of prophecy, as Islam maintains he was. But speculative scholarship, drawing now upon sources that are not in Arabic, but nonetheless, sources that were almost contemporary with the rise of Islam, that is Jewish sources, Armenian sources, Georgian sources, Syriac sources, which is an Aramaic dialect spoken in Syria at that time, and Babylonian sources. Many of these sources picture him not as a prophet espousing a new religion, but as a renegade Jew bringing a modified type of Judaism to the Jews, wanting the Jews to accept this modified type of Judaism, and the Jews turning around saying, "We don't need what you have, we have something already that's much better." Because the greatest disappointment Muhammad has when he comes to the Jews is their total rejection of him. Now there are two ideas I throw out of you, which of course when we look backwards we have perfect vision. But I throw these ideas out because they're speculative ideas. What would have happened if Muhammad had worked out a compromise halakha with the Jews of the Arabian Peninsula? Because we don't know. There are no written sources of the Jews in the Arabian Peninsula. We don't know what they believed in. There are no law codes. There are no Sifrei Torah. There are no books of halakha from that period, from the Jews of the Arabian Peninsula. Second question. What would have happened if the Jews of the Arabian Peninsula had accepted Muhammad as a prophet for the Arab world, giving him kavod, bringing a message to them, but at the same time being allowed to maintain their own religion? Now I'm throwing these two questions out. They can't be answered, but they're very important to understand the source material that is not in Arabic. It's very, very difficult, ladies and gentlemen, to reconstruct a religion from sources that are completely subjective. And to reconstruct a religion, to understand how Jews relate to Muslims at the onset of Islam, without material that is not Arabic, is very, very difficult, if not impossible. Now, nonetheless, we have to move ahead with our story. Now, during this period, I'm trying to condense the background before I get into the Jewish part, so just bear with me. During this period, we have tremendous numbers of confrontations, disputations, if you will, and a medieval type of disputation between Jews and Muslims. And then finally, and we'll speak more about this later, the Jews are expelled from the Arabian Peninsula. By the end of Muhammad's lifetime, or certainly by the beginning of the first caliph, which is Abu Bakr, the Jews, for all intents and purposes, are expelled from the Arabian Peninsula. According to the early caliphs, Muhammad gave direct orders that the Arabian Peninsula is only for one religion. No Christians or Jews allowed to live in the Arabian Peninsula. That is in the northern part of the peninsula. The Yemenite Jews lived there for a very long time, and there's still probably several hundred living there until today, in Yemen, in the south. Now, when Muhammad died, in the year 632, the Islamic community was thrown into a quandary. How do we choose a successor? And of course, there are many, many stories, Islamic legends, if you will, on the meetings that occur at a place called Saqifah to decide what to do to save the community. And what they decided upon was to create the office of Khalifatu Rasuli Allahi. Khalifatu Rasuli Allahi, the successor to the Messenger of God. Khalifa in English, Khalif. Khalifatu Rasuli Allah, the successor to the Messenger of God. And of course, who would become the successor? The Arabs respect the king. Seva. Yipne Seva Fakum. You stand up before an older person. Logically, the wisest of his closest companions, logically, would have been Ali, who was married to Muhammad's daughter. But logic does not work in the Islamic world. So the nod went to one of his first loyal companions, who was Abu Bakr. Abu Bakr was If I remember correctly, about a year or two, either Muhammad Sr. or Muhammad Jr. Nonetheless, his caliphate is very, very important, because with his accession to power, almost immediately, the Islamic community is called the Ummah. Ummah is the Islamic community, is faced with fitna. And fitna is an Arabic word having many shades of meaning. One of the meanings is rebellion, apostasy. They begin to slide back. They begin to rebel. Because there were some among the Arabs who believed that Muhammad was God, or that God should restore his soul and bring him back to life. Nonetheless, the creation of the caliphate saved the community through the efforts of Abu Bakr, who lived for approximately two and a half years, but in that 2.5 year period, he succeeded in conquering the entire Arabian Peninsula and bringing all the pagan tribes in the Arabian Peninsula, bringing them underneath the rule of Islam. So the Islamic flag now flies over the entire Arabian Peninsula, at least figuratively. After Abu Bakr died, he was succeeded by Umar, who was the second caliph, and then Osman, and then Ali. Now Umar and Osman are very, very important relating to the history of the Quran. And why is that? Because the Quran was originally an oral text. It's memorized by people. In fact, you are a Hafiz. Hafiz. You memorize Quran. Hafiz is a professional Quranic memorizer. And many of these Hufaz were dying, and they wanted to preserve this text. Now, depending upon which of the sources you read, either during the time of Umar, his daughter was Hafsa. Hafsa was Umar's daughter. She was also married to Muhammad. And she maintains that during the lifetime of my father, there was a complete text of the Quran. But that's a minority tradition. The majority of the Islamic literature would say that the Quran was written and put into its fixed form during the period of the third caliph, Uthman. And let me explain to you, it's very important that we know how the Quran is structured. For those of us who are familiar with the Hebrew Bible, or read any of the other scriptures of the world religions outside of Islam, we know that we start with Bereshit, and we go to Devarim, and it follows a logical order. In other words, we don't go from Abraham, we don't go from Yosef to Abraham, we start with Abraham, and we go down to Yosef, instead of Bereshit, as far as the Avot and their progeny is concerned. Quran is a book which is not in any chronological order. There are 115 chapters. And they call the word for chapter is surah. Surah is the Hebrew word shura, where things are lined up. The chapters are headed in two ways. One heading is either Mecca or Medina. And if you remember what I said, the chapters from Medina begin in the year 622. The chapters from Mecca are from 610 to 622. But in these chapters, there are sometimes, even in the Meccan chapter, there are verses that relate to the Medinan period. Each and every chapter also has a name. So I'll give you the names of some of the well-known chapters. One is called Al-Fatiha, which is the opening chapter, like Poteach. Then this is a prayer, is said maybe by an observant Muslim 100 times a day. Then we have Surat Al-Baqarah. The chapter of the cow. It has as a central theme the story of the Para Aduma. Then we have Ibrahim. Obviously Abraham. Then a chapter called Banu Israel. Then a chapter called Yusuf. And we can go on and on. Each and every chapter has a name. I tried to give you the names of those that are associated in some way with our tradition. After, okay? Now, the 115 chapters, except for the first chapter, are placed in the Quran in a reverse order of length. Which means to say that the longest chapter is the second chapter, which is Al-Baqarah, is the longest chapter. It's about 280. Ayah is a verse. Ayah is an ot. The word ot in Hebrew is ayah in Arabic. The shortest chapters are the chapters at the end. So if someone is going to a Muslim school, they usually memorize the Quran starting with the shortest chapters and go back. They'll start with the shortest chapters. And they call their school, it's called like a madrasa, like a Beit Midrash. And they'll repeat and repeat and repeat. I had a student of mine in class many years ago. His name was Adam. He was a Yemenite Arab. And by the age of 16, he knew about 3/4 of the Quran by heart. When I asked him to read it, he could read it, but didn't know anything what he was saying. Quranic Arabic is very, very difficult language. The grammar of the Arabic language is something that requires approximately 10 years really to master. A very, very difficult language to master. Now getting back to our story of the structure of the Quran. So during the period of Uthman, the third caliph, according to the traditional Muslim version, the Quran was put into its present order and present structure. So anywhere you go in the world, whether it's Indonesia or Philippines or the mosque of Brighton Beach on Brighton 7th Street, you will find the Quran being read with the Osmanic version. Now there are at times very small variations. The Shia and the Sunni have small variations in how they break the verses. But otherwise you're going to find that they're the same. Much like our Sifrei Torah, they're going to be the same throughout the entire Jewish world. And the same is true with the Quran. Same thing. Okay. Now you had a question.
About what year was the Quran finalized or canonized?
We're talking about approximately about the year 650. But you mentioned a very good question, because what happened to all the variant Qurans? There were memorizers who may have memorized the Quran in a different order, or memorized the surah in a different order, or may have memorized a different surah completely, or a surah with different verses. Theoretically, all those variant Qurans were destroyed after the death of Uthman. They were destroyed. We do have, there was an Israeli scholar, his name was, I think, Yaakov Nevo. And he collected Islamic inscriptions from the 7th, 8th, and 9th century, and he collected coins that were issued throughout the Muslim realm with quotations from the Quran, and he tried to demonstrate in these quotations and in the inscriptions that the variant reading still existed until at least the 8th or 9th century CE. Now, what does that mean?
What is CE?
Common era. A Christian era. Common era. Now, this might mean, and I'm emphasizing might, this might mean that the traditional dating that the Muslim world accepts may in fact be fallacious, may not be accurate, but it requires still much more work. You know, there's a story I may have told last year, but it sort of illustrates the approach of Islam to Judaism as opposed to the Jewish approach to Islam. About 5 years ago, I had the fortune with my family to go to Cairo. And was it a fortuitous trip? Because the Board of Education at that time asked me to write a booklet on Islam for the public high school system. And at that time I was very friendly with the Egyptian ambassador. And she saw the copy and she thought it was very good. And she wanted to send it to Sheikh Tantawi. Now, you know, Sheikh Tantawi is in Egypt, he speaks like a pope for the Sunni Arab world. And I remember I went to meet him, and I'm not going to dwell on the story of what happened before I met him, but when I came into his office, what impressed me, of course, were literally thousands of books all around. And we sat, and there was an interpreter, but we didn't need an interpreter because we spoke in Arabic. And I said to him, Sheikh, I have one question to ask you. What do you really know about the Jewish people? And his answer was, what is written in the Quran and Sunnah is enough. There's nothing more to know. Now, I'm contrasting his approach. This is an intellect in the Muslim world with a PhD in theology, whose voice of authority rings for hundreds of millions of people. You have to understand this. What he says is listened to by hundreds of millions of people in the Sunni Arab and Muslim world. And here is his answer, that Jewish history, 5,000 years of Jewish history, has no meaning. The only thing that counts with regard to the Jews is what is written in the Quran. Allah is the Quran. What is in the Quran? That's all it is interesting. He even wrote a book I have at home, his doctoral dissertation, which is called Banu Israel fi al-Quran wa Sunnah. That's the children of Israel in the Quran and tradition. And of course, needless to say, it's not a very complimentary book. Now, getting back to our story. With regard to the first meeting of Jews and Arabs, we first have to understand that when did the Jews arrive in the Arabian Peninsula? When did the Jews first have dealings with anyone in the Arabian Peninsula? And we know the answer, because it happened during the time of Melech Shlomo with Malka Sheba, the Queen of Sheba, which is approximately in the early 10th century BCE. Sheba was the kingdom of the south, where it's today Yemen. But there's no indication, to my knowledge, anywhere in Mikra, as to any Jewish settlement during the biblical period in the Arabian Peninsula. In fact, the word Arabi, to my recollection, is not mentioned anywhere in Torah. In later books, yes, with Arabi. Now, when do Jews definitely begin to move into the Arabian Peninsula in large numbers It begins after the Korban Bayis Sheni. And we know this not from any archaeological finds, because you're not allowed to go into the Arabian Peninsula and look for archaeological relics. We know it from a Dead Sea Scroll, because one of the less known Dead Sea Scrolls mentions the king Nabunaid, who was in the Nebuchadnezzar line. It mentions his foray into Yatarimu. Yatarimu? Yatarimu is the older name for Medina. In Arabic, it's Yathrib, which is the name of Medina before it became the center, or one of the centers of Islam. And this Dead Sea Scroll text, based upon the paleography, the structure of the letters, and the papyrus that it's on, is somewhere between the 1st and 2nd century BCE to the 1st century CE. And it's a Jewish hand that has written this text. So already the Jews are familiar with Yathrib, with Yatarimu, which indicates the possibility that Jews may have been living in the Arabian Peninsula somewhere either just before or just after the Korban Bayit Sheni, which is 70 CE. Jews escaping from Israel, from Judea, making their way into the Arabian Peninsula. We do know that the Arab tradition had a vague recollection of the northern Arab tradition, had a vague recollection of what is called the Milit Ibrahim. Milit Ibrahim is the religion of Abraham. And in the early chapters of the Quran, there's no association of Abraham with the Islamic religion. The association between Abraham, Ibrahim, and Islam comes in the later tradition, more in the Medina chapters rather than in the Mecca chapters. Abraham is mentioned as being the believer, the founder of the first monotheistic belief, and the first temple that was built in Mecca. That's the Arab association, the northern Arab association with Abraham. So getting back to our story, Jews probably lived, yes?
What's their reference to Abraham?
There was in their genealogical lists.
Okay.
Of their begotten, they trace their genealogy. They have a vague reference to Ibrahim. So in their understanding of their place, the northern Arabs feel in their genealogical list that they are a descendant of Abraham, much as the Jews are descendants of Yitzhak.
So they feel that Abraham went to Mecca and did something there.
Yeah, built a temple to Allah.
It's a product.
Okay, now, getting back to our story. Now, assuming that there was a Jewish presence in the Yathrib, and of course in the surrounding areas, what type of Jews, in fact, lived in the Arabian Peninsula? What did they believe in? What were their customs? What were their traditions? What was their language? Well, it's very, very, very difficult to answer that question with precision. The evidence we have is that they spoke Arabic. Remember the term Al-Jahiliyya is the pre-Islamic period? In the Al-Jahiliyya period, there were collections of poems. The Arabs were very, very facile in reciting poetry. And in fact, in the city of Ukaz is a city in the Arabian Peninsula, they would have a fair every year. And people would recite poetry. the Arabs would have a contest whose poems would be the most difficult to recite and who would develop the finest poetic techniques. When you study Arabic language, the last thing you usually study, the one that most students cut the class usually for, would be the lectures on the Arabic meters. The meter in poetry is very, very difficult. And we find a very famous, it quotes Arab-Jewish poet whose name is Ibn Samu'el. Ibn Samu'el al-Yahudi, the Jew. And he is living somewhere in the mid-6th century CE. And in fact, he is a good friend, of the most famous of the Jahiliya poets, Imri al-Qais. They are contemporaries with each other. His language is Arabic, the pure literary Arabic of Quran. His imagery is Arabic. The way he colors his words, the images he evokes with his language, there's nothing in quotes Jewish about him at all, except his ancestry. Nothing. Excuse me? There's very little biographical material known about him for one simple reason, and that is the Arabs were not concerned with preserving, number one, Jahiliya poetry, for two reasons. Number one, Muhammad looked down upon poets. Number two, it was developed during the period before Islam. And anything developed during the period before Islam, at best, is rejected. And in fact, the collections of pre-Islamic poetry are usually edited by, not always, but usually edited by Arab Christians. The most famous collection is about 5 volumes, and is edited by a priest named Louis Schaeffel. Schaeffel was a great Lebanese scholar, I believe he was a Roman Catholic, and he gathered hundreds of pre-Islamic poems, and he edited them with commentary. But Muslims usually, they don't, except for Ibn al-Qais perhaps, who's, and maybe Antara's name was, they usually do not deal with the pre-Islamic period. So getting back to our story, Jewish people in the Arabian Peninsula land, for all intents and purposes, were Arab in custom, Arab in language, Arab in understanding of what has to be done, which is called, in their relationship with each other, which is called Muruwa. Muruwa is a very important word in the pre-Islamic period. It means manliness. The willingness to die if need be, just to preserve a handshake. So Ibn Samu'el, there's a very famous story that's told where, I remember some of the details, just popped in my head. Someone gives him armor suit to watch, to guard, while he's on his travels. And he says, you're not to turn this armor suit over to anyone. And in the course of the wars, which were very frequent in the Arabian Peninsula, someone captures his son and says, you'll turn over the armor suit of my adversary or your son will be executed. The armor suit was not turned over. The child was executed. But he had to preserve his oath. And he had to preserve his muruwa, his manliness of, you might say, biting his finger even when there's extreme pain. Not to give in. So Muhammad, getting back to our story.
Well, I'm sorry, you said Jews are collected?
Yes.
It's true.
But they were religious people.
Excuse me?
At that time, everybody was religious.
We're talking about the Arabian Peninsula.
You said Jewish people?
Yes.
I mean, everybody observed the Torah and everything.
Well, I can't answer your question because were you here before?
I'm sorry, no.
Number one, the
major reason why I can't answer your question, I can't really respond to it, is because the source material is Arabic source material. I wouldn't say there's nothing, but there's virtually nothing we have in the hands of Jews from this period, which tells us how they lived and what rules they followed in terms of halakha. No information at all. So we're dealing with a subjective source. It's a Muslim source material. Somehow we have to extract from a Muslim source material, if possible, what and how the Jews lived during this period. Now, getting back to our story. In Medina, Muhammad was faced with a challenge from the Jewish people on three planes. He was faced with a religious challenge, he was faced with a political challenge, and he was faced with an economic challenge. The only way to overcome these three challenges was to remove the Jews completely, either physically or politically, from the scene. And this was done through war and through extermination. The three groups we mentioned before, we have information as to two of them. The Banu Nadir lived in an oasis area near Khaybar in the Arabian Peninsula. And they were expelled in two stages from the Arabian Peninsula during the lifetime of Muhammad. The Banu Qurayza for 25 days, the Banu Qurayza withstood the siege of the Muslim forces. When their resources, their food resources and weapons, dwindled down to almost nothing, they tried to negotiate an agreement similar to what the Banu Nadir had extracted from Muhammad. In other words, to be allowed to leave the Arabian Peninsula with their lives. However, this was not to be. In this confederation of Islamic and pagan Arabs, one of the pagan Arab tribesmen, on his deathbed, made the Islamic forces promise that he would exterminate every male member of the Banu Qurayza, and all women and children would be sold as slaves. Now, based upon the sources we have, between 600 and 900 men were beheaded, executed. Now, I remember when the Saudi Arabians made their so-called peace overture when the Intifada started. One of the members of the Saudi family said that this can't be allowed to happen. Why? Because when the Jews come here as tourists, the first thing they will do is take the site of the Banu Qurayza's execution in Makom Kadosh. With the execution of the male members of the Banu Qurayza and the expulsion of the Banu Nadir from the Arabian Peninsula, except for pockets here and there, the Arabian Peninsula becomes, as the term is, Yudran. No Jewish are in the Arabian Peninsula any longer. Muhammad has now closed the circle. He is no longer delivering a message of magnanimous message to Jews and Christians. By the time the Banu Qurayza are exterminated, he now views Islam in terms of three circles. The first revelation of God to humanity was the Jewish revelation, which is Torah. The Arabs call it Taurat. The second revelation, the Christian revelation, is called Injil. And the third revelation to humanity is called Quran. All the revelations are from God, except the Quran is the only revelation that is completely true. The Quran is not the compilation of Muhammad in Islamic tradition. The Quran is coming from God. The Quran was always with God in Arabic, waiting for the right moment to be revealed. Just read one little article to you that you have in front of you. If you look at the second page, it says 151. This will give you an idea of what Islam says about the Jewish in the Quran. Indeed, you'll surely find that the most vehement of men in enmity to those who believe are the Jews and the polytheists. But you will also surely find that the closest of them in love to those who believe are those who say they are Christians. That is because there are among them priests and monks, and because they are not Arabic. Now, in this sheet, you have many, many statements on how Islam views Christians and Jews. There is nothing in here, I want to emphasize this, that is racial intent. It's primarily a reflection of rivalry in religion, rivalry in economics, rivalry in politics. But what has happened today, put the cart before the horse, is that Islam has become the tool for anti-Semitism. That the Alawimi, the Jews and the Christians who were supposed to be the protected people under Islam, are no longer the protected people under Islam, but we are considered to be Kufar. We are considered to be non-believers and al-shirk, people who would be idolaters. We are polytheists. And polytheists, according to Islam, only have one choice. What is that choice? It's conversion or death. Thank you very much.
I stopped at about 650.
Oh, only covered about 50 years.
One question is the limit.
Why is it easy to convert to Islam? Well, all you have to really do is say, I believe in Allah, Muhammad is his prophet. You know, three times in front of a believing Muslim, you sign a document in which you give up your previous religion, if you have a religion, and you're a Muslim. So there's no Tabillah, there's no Rapport you have to learn, there's no course in Gerut. It's very, very simple. That's one of the reasons why their numbers are slowing, especially in the prisons of the United States. There are blacks who convert to Islam. I can't say why, but they feel that perhaps Christianity is a slave owner's religion. And now they're going back to their African roots. That's the only possible reason I can give. I can only say what my board has to be saved for tomorrow.
No.
I can't.
That's it. They'll be next time, Bezrat Hashem, because we've only done 50 years.
Only 50 years.
There's many, many years to continue. I'd like to thank, on behalf of everyone, I'd like to thank Dr. Richard Tombeck for his interesting and elucidating lecture to us. Thank you very much. Okay. Stay tuned, because this series is going to continue in the spring, perhaps. We'll let you know. And there are a lot of classes and activities going on, and we hope that you will join us. At this time, we'll invite the ladies to enjoy the refreshments inside, and the men can stay here for Arvid, after which I'm sure there'll be some refreshments left for the men as well. Thank you very much. Thank you.